My guest this week is Pather Kirby, Professor Emeritus of International Politics and Public Policy at the University of Limerick. I first came across Pather in the 1970s when he reported on developments in Latin America for the Irish Times. He's now turned his attention to the Irish language. His new pamphlet argues that the collapse of Irish has as much to do with the fact that it was traditionally tied to nationalism. Furthermore, our national identity to begin with was always more Catholic than Gaelic. The necessity for re-Europeanising Ireland, published by Cushcame, suggests that the Irish language is a valuable resource for bringing about a better economic and social life. Pather Kirby, you're welcome.
Thank you, Andy.
What first drew you to the Irish language?
Well, I suppose I have had a natural sense of the importance of the Irish language since my teenage years, when in some ways I made a sort of an emotional discovery of it in secondary school. I put that down to some wonderful teachers, particularly Owen O'Sullivan in Castleknock College, who in our fifth year teaching us Irish for the Leaving Cert decided to put aside the curriculum, and he spent a whole year teaching us the history of Western philosophy through Irish. I still have the notes of that year. And it influenced me not just in terms of my love for Irish and my ability to communicate through Irish, but it influenced me enormously in terms of my love of ideas. He came to the launch of the pamphlet. I was really touched at the beginning of March in Boswell's Hotel in Dublin. And I said that to him. I was delighted I got a chance to say it to him, that I felt that influence marked my life profoundly. So for me, Irish has never been something apart, just a language that I could use occasionally. It has been something in which I feel part of me comes alive that isn't there with English. In fact, the older I grow, I have an abiding sense of a sort of a... It really is an emotional sense that there part of me is missing, that is only activated when I speak Irish. And I mean, to use the language of rights, which is very predominant now, I really feel that a fundamental right has been taken from me by my inability to be able to live my life through Irish. And I suspect there are other people in Ireland that feel that also.
The revivalists of a century ago, and you make this point, also saw it as a resource. But what went wrong meantime?
The foundation of the independent Irish state is my conclusion, because if you go back, and it was only when I began researching this maybe about 20 years ago that I was surprised to realise just how major a social movement the Gaelic League had become in the 1900s and the 1910s before the 1916 Rising. And I think Douglas Hyde's fundamental insight that the language shouldn't become a weapon of politics has proven to be right, because once it was politicised by the volunteers, by Pearce, etc., then I think it became elevated out of the realm of civil society, as we'd say today, into the realm of the state. When we set up the independent state, the state decided then that the burden of language revival would be placed upon the schools and upon children, which has had some successes, I think, in laying the foundations of more widespread knowledge of the language than otherwise would be the case. But it really involves a terrible hypocrisy that the state purports to be in favour of the revival of the language, but about the only thing it has done is to impose it on children. There's been very little effort. There's been no planning, language planning, which of course is absolutely essential, as to how one would spread the use of language more widely. I mean, the very first time that we had a debate among the main political leaders before a general election in Irish was in 2011. Why didn't that become the norm back in the 1920s and 1930s?
By the way, our leaders today, it so happens, are quite fluent. Is that anomalous? I mean, hasn't been like that.
It's anomalous given given most of my adult life, when most of our Taoiseach and presidents really hardly spoke any Irish, which was an acute embarrassment. I think it's wonderful now that all our political leaders and our president not just can speak Irish, but they're fluent in it and they appreciate the value of it. But that's the sort of level of leadership that we would have needed from the state, from our business leaders. You know, there are some business leaders who have done work for Irish, but very, 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 very few.
So do you cringe at the tokenism at Ordeshina?
I cringe at the tokenism at anything, Andy. Mm. I cringe at the way in which we put up road signs in Irish, in which you have the most blatant misspellings and grammatical mistakes that you know a 10-year-old shouldn't be making. And we all seem to accept them. I mean, what does it say about ourselves that we treat our language with such cavalier disregard? It is the only thing we have that's our own. It is a language of rich importance to European civilization. And yet we treat it with disdain. I find this psychologically absolutely puzzling. I talk to friends of mine who are psychotherapists, and I ask them, does this ever come up when they are dealing in through therapy with clients who are trying to come to grips with fundamental blockages? Because I think our whole nation has been blocked in its development by its inability to deal with the legacy of a traumatic language shift within human memory.
Well, to what extent do you think the revivalists were trying to address defects in our way of thinking?
I think there was always that strain there. There was always a strain among people, and we go back to Thomas Davis in the 1840s, who had an intuitive sense of the importance of the language, that this was not just for cultural reasons, it was for reasons of our development as a community, as an economy, as a society. And as I argue in the pamphlet, it's only now, I think, with the latest developments in some branches of the social sciences, that we can actually say that they were right, that we can give a theoretical foundation to these insights that they had, which by and large have been left go astray. Because after the state was founded, it seems to me that some of those fundamental insights were completely lost sight of, and Irish was just thought of as being a badge of identity. But the language revivalists saw it as being far, far more than a badge of identity. They saw it as being an absolutely essential resource for our successful socioeconomic development. And I find it very interesting that 90 years after independence, we are now living through the greatest economic and social crisis that we've lived through. And ultimately, as our president keeps telling us, this is an intellectual crisis.
What does he mean by that? What does Michael D. mean by that, in your view?
It's a crisis of the way in which we think about ourselves, our past, our present, and our future. It's a crisis about our ambition to make of ourselves seriously a society which can really be marked by progressive values of equality, of humanity, of the ways we treat each other.
The question is, and this is the central question, by the way, could that be done? Could that kind of revival occur without the Irish language? That sense of moving towards independence of thought and moving towards that, could all of that be done without the language?
Well, Andy, I have spent the last 20 years as an academic studying Irish development. And I suppose the longer I've gone on, the more it seems to me that we have very, very fundamental value-based weaknesses that we're not addressing. I mean, one of the absolute anomalies of our development in Ireland is that we depend to a level by world standards that's very extreme on foreign investment. And we keep our taxes on corporate profits made by some of the world's most profitable corporations very low, even at a time where taxes are being raised on the rest of us. And there's no debate about this.
Well, that could be remedied, though. My point is, surely people could argue that could be remedied without the Irish language being revived.
Well, as I argue in the pamphlet, it seems to me that there are a number of fundamental weaknesses. I've just identified one, which I think goes back to a lack, really, of faith in ourselves. Mm-hmm. And a lack of a sense that out of our own native abilities that we could really develop our society. And in the pamphlet, you've seen it, I mean, I argue that perhaps some of this can be addressed through English, but the fullest way of addressing it is to make again of the Irish language a vibrant part of our everyday lives, of the ways in which we think about ourselves, our society, our problems, in the ways in which we dream about a better future and plan seriously, because I think we've never done serious socioeconomic planning in this country.
Yes, I mean, you invoked Joe Lee fairly early on, his critique of the kind of dependent thinking and doing things foreign ways and so on, not thinking for ourselves.
Importing our ideas and political ideas without realising that in importing ideas, you're importing really a whole framework of thinking.
Yeah, but your key premise is, though, is that there's a link between that lack of independence of thought and so on, and the lack of a collectivist set of values, and the lack of our own distinctive language. You do feel that.
A language to me embodies a sense of oneself. If it embodies fundamental values, it embodies an ability to be able to talk to oneself, hold a conversation with the national community about ourselves that isn't full of the noise that comes from outside. I think we're particularly unlucky to speak a language which is the language of the great imperialist powers of the world over the last 500 years, and which is full of messages that are completely inappropriate messages for a latecomer to development, a small peripheral economy and society on the edge of Europe, which I think has never found its way. I know Iceland well. I'm an adjunct professor in the University of Iceland. Mm-hmm. Iceland is a country of 320,000 people. Every time I go into a bookshop in Iceland, I'm astonished at the number of books published in Icelandic.
Yes.
I mean, there are, what, one-third the number of people who claimed in the last census that they speak Irish who speak Icelandic, and yet Icelandic is an absolutely vibrant language. I'm always struck when I'm at the university there, they have their sessions through English, and then they have their sessions through Icelandic. And as I study, and I've done a joint study with a colleague in Iceland comparing the Irish financial crisis and the Icelandic financial crisis, and theirs in many ways was worse than ours. But they've managed to face it and to come out of it in a far more decisive way.
Yeah.
Now, ultimately, those traits in a national culture do go back to language, it seems to me, to a sense of oneself in that language.
Yeah, the point, though, is that notion that separate languages entail different ways of looking at the real world, that particular view has been taking a hammering of late. The idea that, you know, that language affects the way we perceive the world. What seems to me is less questionable, I mean, I think that seems to me the jury is out on that. What's less questionable is the value of language as a resource of, in the matter of self-understanding. In other words, you could argue, as Michal Cronin does in his book about in Goelges and Ishnur, that parts of our past are cut off from us, that we simply, without the language, you need language as a tool to have adequate self-understanding. So it seems to me, forgive me for going on about this, that the second, that language is more useful, a separate language, in the second sense than in the first.
I don't distinguish the two senses completely, and I don't know why you say that the first is being discredited now. I'm not a linguist. But I do know from my own experience.
I'm thinking of the work that's been largely sort of summarized and marshaled by Steve Pinker, who in effect has been attacking linguistic determinism, the view that language determines our view of reality, the famous Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which governed for many years. Now, I know this is a contentious area and there are differing views, but I think that what seems to me, while that particular approach to the language is questionable, what's less questionable is the notion of language as a tool of self-understanding.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I can only speak from my own experience in this. I have no academic expertise, but from my knowledge of socioeconomic issues, in which I do have some expertise, I do note that language seems to me to be a variable that's not sufficiently attended to. Now, when I say language, I'm really referring to something much wider. I'm referring to culture, to values. Values in the sense of what really informs the way in which a society views itself and envisages its future. And that's where I think we're very impoverished in Ireland.
Yeah. You could also argue, I mean, if we've developed a kind of individualism here, perhaps you could argue that it's the fact that language, that English was the primary language, and therefore that the kind of literature we absorbed came from the Anglo-Saxon world, and that predisposed us towards a particular view of political economy.
You could.
Yeah. would that be your view?
I suppose at heart, my view is, I'd make a distinction here between two things. One is the sorts of ideas that we have imbibed by being so dominated by English language texts and by the English language. I'm not arguing against the English language. I'm very lucky to speak the English language, and of course it is the dominant world language. So it's really important, I think, given the history of certain attitudes about Irish, that there's no communication in what I'm saying that I'm against English. I'm not. We're richly endowed by speaking English. It's the absence of the filters that a native language will give you to say, yes, these ideas are wonderful and they're absolutely appropriate, but these ideas aren't.
Yeah,
I think we lack those filters.
Yeah, but at the back of your mind is this notion that language, that the Irish language is more congruent with collectivist cooperative values than it is with individualist ones.
Well, now, I haven't said that, and I don't argue that, but you're veering in that direction, that there's a hidden subtext. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. You veer in that direction. Towards identifying Irish language with particular values and with, as I say, the collectivist ones and so on.
Yes, I do.
So when you talk about the re-Europeanising, what have you in mind there, Pather, in terms of I mean, as you rightly say, we've seen Europe as a kind of with a begging bowl mentality, as something, in terms of what we could get from it. We haven't really been part of it at all.
I suppose in the back of my mind, I have Mary Harney's division between Boston and Berlin, which, I mean, from the very beginning seemed to me to be absolutely spurious. And I think the way subsequent developments have gone makes us realise that if she said that we were spiritually closer to Boston, we're now, of course, dependent upon Berlin to bail us out. And there's an irony in all that. And so reflecting on that, it's to say that we have, particularly over recent decades, I think, being pulled towards a sort of an Anglo-Saxon model of how we organise ourselves, which gives priority to the values of the market and the private sector and really weakens the state and the state's ability to, if you like, make sure that the market serves the good of society and serves the good of public goals. And you know, as I know Europe, and I do live part of the year in Spain, where I'm lucky enough to own an apartment, I'm very struck by the strength of public values, and even the way in which architecture and public spaces are planned embodies a very different set of values than mark our architecture and our public spaces, just to take one example.
Sure.
And one can generalise that into whole vast areas of public policy making. So when I talk about re-Europeanising Ireland, I'm talking about it in two senses. One is that we would begin again to realise that we're part of this continent, and you know, 1,000 years ago gave huge cultural riches.
We should all be trilingual. I mean, people should have Irish, English, and French or German, presumably.
Well, that's the second dimension of it, and it's the narrower meaning of it, and that is that the norm in Europe is that people at least are bilingual in a real sense, that they can move easily from one language to another. I mean, the dominant language being the English language, but then that their own mother tongue being the language that provides them with really the ability to link themselves to one another and have a sense of themselves as a national community.
What's amazing to me, Father, and I'm not as warmly attached to it as you are, I haven't thought about it as deeply, is this, that what's amazing is I can understand how we moved to English and that became the dominant language. What I find harder to understand is why we jettisoned Irish at the same time, why we didn't keep both.
And I think that goes back to a very painful past. It's interesting that when I lived in Peru for 2 years, I saw happening exactly what happened in Ireland in the 19th century. I was profoundly shocked by it, that Quechua-speaking adults moving to Lima and living in the shantytowns in Lima and speaking very little Spanish were forbidding their children from speaking Spanish at home because they realised that speaking Quechua in a city like Lima was a badge of poverty. And so it's the identification of language with socioeconomic decline and poverty that really was the reason, I think, that for an awful long time that people wanted to jettison Irish instead of seeing bilingualism as a rich goal, which now I think is psychological research, et cetera, shows to be true, that people who are bilingual they develop parts of their brain that people who are monolingual don't. So we have the potential in Ireland to be a richly bilingual society. This resource, we sort of leave it aside and we unvalue it.
I remember doing a television programme with young people in the early 70s, and I noticed then that the standard of spoken Irish among them was much lower than I remembered from my day. What happened in the meantime? Something seems to have happened in the late 50s, 60s and 70s.
Well, I suppose what happened was, one thing that happened was that the state effectively ceased to believe in its revivalist policy. And since then, the state continues in a half-hearted way with some support for Irish, but really has no coherent sense of what it wants to do about the language. We need a national debate about that. I think we need to have a second stage of the language revival movement and to broaden it out with far more ambitious goals in terms of language planning, etc. But the second thing, Andy, is the natural decline that will come to any language that ceases to be the language more and more of real vernacular communities. And that's, I mean, when I started teaching Irish through Irish in DCU, in the late 1990s, I was shocked at the poor standard of Irish of students who were studying everything through Irish, and indeed a resistance from students to believe that there's such a thing as good right grammar and wrong grammar. They'd say, you're cramping my style, my creativity, when they were making the most fundamental grammatical mistakes.
We've been talking about the Irish language in two senses, as a kind of possible tool towards some kind of socio-economic, indeed cultural revival, and as a tool of self-understanding. And I've just remembered a great line from Terence McCaughey, the Reverend Terence McCaughey in Trinity, who said to me many years ago on the second function, the second role, that knowing the Irish language is part of the process of proper remembering.
Yes, absolutely.
That's a very good phrase.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yes, yeah.
But proper remembering in the sense of bringing back into our consciousness a very painful past that I think we haven't fully dealt with. And beginning to deal with it.
De Mouchon de Freyne's book in the, I think that was in the 1960s, called
The Great Silence,
was an attempt to deal with it, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, there have been a number of people who have tried to remind us of this resource. I was asked recently to speak about a wonderful new film that's just come out. What's the name of it? Leaving It in Our Wake. Pat Collins is the director of it. Now, it's not exclusively focused on the Irish language, but again, it's an attempt to draw us back to these hidden dimensions of aspects of ourselves and of where we've come from that really we've tried to jettison instead of dealing with and bringing along with us. I think that the resistance, for example, to the current property tax indicates, again, our problematic relationship to land that goes back to have been a people who were dispossessed. And we need to remember that and to have a sense of our own past.
But we've also got to get over this, the sort of anti-British, anti-English in the way we have been. I mean, for example, I mean, you say Dougloss Dehedia's De-Anglicising Ireland in 1892. I know that was an inspiration for you, but you don't think that's quite on the money now.
Yeah, I certainly totally agree with you that if people in Ireland still have a hostility to England and to the British, it's about time we got over it.
There's absolutely
nothing in what I'm saying that indicates any hostility.
Nor was I implying that.
What, I mean, my subtitle, deliberately put in English in a pamphlet written entirely in Irish, is obviously an echo of Douglas Hyde's, but I deliberately want to put the focus on not de-Anglicising Ireland. And, of course, when you read his pamphlet, his sense of de-Anglicising wasn't that we do away with English. It was a sense, his basic point was that as long as we speak only English, we're going to be imitating the English.
Yeah, and also, in fairness, I suppose De Hedia has to be seen in his context.
I think he had a very profound insight and history has proven him right. But now I think we need to put the emphasis upon making us realise that if we were, through some audacious national change of heart, which I would dearly wish would happen, to really make an effort to become again a truly bilingual people with Irish at the heart of our sense of ourselves and our everyday lives, then in doing that we are becoming more European, and we need to become more European, both because our future is linked to Europe and Europe is now in crisis and we need to, but I mean more fundamentally because we need to bring something to that and not always be taking from it. And give ourselves a sense again that we did, our ancestors over 1,000 years ago, brought a rich, rich cultural value system to Europe. And it continues to be appreciated, of course, throughout Europe.
Yeah.
And yet we have little sense of that.
My good friend Noel Sherlock, who drew this pamphlet of yours to my attention, mentioned to me that there's some talk of you translating it into English. Is that right?
Well, I'm resisting translating it into English because I feel people should make some effort to read the original in Irish. And I don't think a text in English can say what I want to say as effectively as it can in Irish. However, what I am now thinking of doing is writing an article about these ideas in English that I would offer, for example, to the Irish Times.
And there's also the possibility of doing on both pages, you know, doing two versions in the one book. That's a possibility, isn't it? And
it is.
That doesn't appeal to me
because I think that sends the message that really what you have are that in two languages what you have are equivalent meanings. And of course, my fundamental sense is that that's not true. That you can only say things in a certain way.
I think you're absolutely right, and that struck me reading your pamphlet. I suddenly realised that the Irish way of expressing this is a better way. It's sharper or tighter, or whatever it was in particular contexts.
Well, I can't tell you exactly why it's different, and I'm not even arguing it's better. But I said something there that even though in many ways I'm more fluent in English than I am in Irish, I can't say in Irish. I have the same sense speaking Spanish. I speak a lot of Spanish and I write in Spanish, but there are things I can say in Spanish that I can't say in English.
What age were you, by the way, when you had what one might call a breakthrough point in terms of your fluency in the Irish
about
language?
About 14 or 15. It was about second and third year in secondary school. And it was a sudden, immediate sense of discovery, reading poetry or something. I mean, I do have a sense of it happening in study. I was in boarding school, so we studied together. And suddenly something coming alive in me and the discovery of a part of myself. That was really a breakthrough. And ever since then, it's been a really precious part of me. I've raised my daughters speaking only to them in Irish up until they were well into their teens, because I think it's the most valuable gift I could pass on to them. And I think they appreciate that now. And I see them being very easy in different linguistic situations, which to me is a great gift, so that when we're in France or Spain, they have no difficulty being open to the languages being spoken there.
Father Kirby, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Andy.